It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Proposed changes to the state constitution are heading to voters for a final say in the November election. Yesterday, the measures passed out of the state Senate, giving the final okay. One amendment targets the government's diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. Another would bar the government from closing down houses of worship during times of emergency. A third constitutional amendment would limit the governor's partial veto power that also passed the Senate yesterday and will make it to the statewide ballot once it clears the assembly. To hear more about the Senate session yesterday and what these constitutional amendments would do, we have WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson with us. Sean, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
These ballot measures, they're meant to make changes to Wisconsin's constitution. Can you remind us, what is the process for getting a constitutional amendment on the ballot?
Yeah, so what they have to do in the legislature is pass a resolution out of the full legislature in two consecutive sessions. So when we talk about something that has made it to the ballot, that means it already passed last session, the Senate and the Assembly, and then it passed again, an identical version passed again this session through the Assembly and Senate. And once that happens, it goes before voters, and it's up to them to decide whether the Constitution is indeed amended or these things get rejected.
And the governor doesn't have a power to stop these amendments.
He does not. And I mean, that's kind of key in our current dynamic of state government, because we have seen Democratic Governor Tony Evers veto record numbers of Republican bills. It is a clear example of where divided government matters, and that, you know, when you have a governor from one party and a legislature from the other, you know, the one party can't just get everything they want. But when it comes to constitutional amendments, it sidesteps the governor entirely. It's up to voters to veto these things if they choose to.
The state has seen an increase in constitutional amendments advancing to a statewide ballot in recent years, five in 2024 alone. What is behind this increase?
I think for Republicans, they view it as a way to get their agenda done in this atmosphere. You know, they don't have to cut a deal with the governor. They don't have to come his way on this stuff. And in some cases, they pass constitutional amendments that are designed to, you know, restrict the power of the governor or his administration. So those are a few factors, but they all kind of come back to this divided government that we have. And there's also, you know, when you have a legislature that takes these steps, that says, let's put these in the Constitution, they are collectively saying, hey, we believe in these so much that we want them to be basically forever. You know, a law can be repealed, passed by one legislature and repealed by the next. But a constitutional amendment, to change that, you have to go through the same process all over again. So it's fairly permanent.
Well, let's look at these amendments. One focuses on diversity, equity, and inclusion in state government, and if passed by voters, how would this change the Constitution and affect government agencies?
So the amendment would, you know, according to an analysis by the legislature's, nonpartisan attorneys, bar government from discriminating against or granting preferential treatment to any individual or group on the basis of race, sex, color, ethnicity, or national origin. So it's a fairly broad brush there that it's going after. And when you're talking about granting preferential treatment to, that can mean a wide variety of things. And so it very well could go after any number of programs or initiatives that, perhaps don't necessarily have a flashing neon sign that says DEI or diversity, equity, inclusion, but nevertheless are designed to boost opportunities for minorities or women somehow in government.
Republicans have brought up this federal investigation into the Green Bay Area Public School District as evidence as to why the amendment is needed. How does this case relate?
I think that's definitely something that you've heard in this, the argument from Republicans for these initiatives. This was a complaint that was filed by the conservative law firm, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, which alleged that a student was denied reading resources because he was white, citing a school success plan where the district allegedly prioritized students of other races. But I think this is part of a much bigger push that dates back, you know, many years. In Wisconsin specifically, it's been a real push by Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who is the most powerful Republican in the state legislature. A few years ago, you know, there was this kind of back and forth between Voss and the University of Wisconsin over, you know, whether to give pay raises to UW mm-hmm. employees and a new capital building plan. And Voss said, if you're going to get these things, I'm going to insist on these changes to DEI practices. He got what he was looking for. And he said at the time, quote, Republicans know this is just the first step in what will be our continuing efforts to eliminate these cancerous DEI practices. So that's how he views it. We now have President Donald Trump in the White House who uses very strong language when he's talking about DEI. So it's definitely part of a big push, both Wisconsin and nationally.
We have WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson with us as lawmakers advance constitutional amendments and looking at what the changes would mean in the state constitution if voters approve them in the fall. Another constitutional amendment that is awaiting final passage by the Assembly has to do with the governor's partial veto power. The veto power has a long history in Wisconsin. What would this amendment mean to the governor's partial veto abilities?
This amendment would specifically say that the governor can't use their partial veto over an appropriation bill, and so a bill that spends money, mm-hmm. to create or increase any tax or fee. So it's definitely a nod to the governor's partial veto that we, you know, refer to as the 400-year veto. This is where Governor Tony Evers took a revenue limit increase for schools that was supposed to last over the course of a 2-year budget. And by, very creative use of the governor's partial veto, he extended that to 400 years. And this is something that was upheld by the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So it is the law of the land that that partial veto, the 400-year veto, stands. This amendment wouldn't undo that, but it would say that a future governor wouldn't be able to use the partial veto in that way.
Both parties have launched criticism, for the other party abusing the veto power. Is veto power a uniqueness of Wisconsin authority?
Yeah. I mean, you hear about line item vetoes mm-hmm. with a lot of governors, and the partial veto is not the same. You know, a line item veto, they got to take out an entire line. Mm-hmm. A Wisconsin governor looks at that and just kind of laughs. You know, that's just such a small power compared to what a Wisconsin governor can do with this, just these tiny little vetoes that really, you know, rewrite a budget, frankly. There are some limitations that voters in previous referendums have put on governors, they were referred to as the Vanna White veto and the Frankenstein veto. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the governor can't create a new word by rejecting individual letters, and they can't create a new sentence by combining parts of two or more sentences. Other than that, you know, a governor can do what they want. So it's a very powerful veto pen in Wisconsin compared to other states.
Okay. Constitutional Amendment number 3, houses of worship, the houses of worship and their ability to keep their doors open. What would this do?
So remember the debates that we had in, you know, the early days and years of COVID. Yeah. Kind of revives those, but specific to public health orders that would, you know, force people or ban people from large gatherings in houses of worship. So this is something that the state of Wisconsin did, along with other states, banning large gatherings at church. The idea at the time was we didn't have any vaccines for COVID. We didn't know much about it. And so the state said, let's not have a bunch of people in a confined space. It could cause the virus to spread. Republicans are saying, you know, the U.S. Constitution is pretty clear on this, and we should never again restrict somebody's freedom to worship. So that's what this amendment would do. It would be specific to those types of bans, and would say that the state or any other local government can't do that again.
So these constitutional amendments coming to the midterm elections, November ballot, Republicans, meanwhile, they do face political headwinds. Does the political climate affect whether these constitutional amendments get through by voters?
I think, you know, conventional wisdom when one party puts these things on the ballot is that that party thinks it's going to be good for them, that these are issues that they're happy to have out there, and perhaps it'll drive their people out to the polls. So even though it's, you know, historically, this looks like it's going to be a Democratic year. Republicans are putting these initiatives that they kind of like their odds on before voters, and, you know, in an effort probably to get them out there. You did hear one Democrat, Tim Carpenter of Milwaukee, saying, hey, this has backfired on you before. You can sometimes generate turnout among the other party. He cited the 2006 amendment banning same-sex marriage in Wisconsin, which turned up Democratic turnout in on-campus wards. So the political element of these things is something that can't be ignored. And so, you know, we'll be voting for governor this year. We'll be voting for races for the legislature, and we'll be voting in three proposed amendments likely to the Wisconsin Constitution.
Sean, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for the update.
Good to talk with you.
Sean Johnson is WPR's Capital Bureau Chief, and we've been talking about these constitutional amendments coming to statewide ballots in the fall and what they do if enshrined into the state constitution. Coming up, Wisconsin is getting older. We kick off a series of interviews on the impact of the state's aging population, starting with the trends and what's driving them.
The fastest age range of growth has been, and probably for the next decade, will be in the age 65 plus group.
That's next on Wisconsin Today. This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On the campaign trail in 2024, President Donald Trump made inflation and the cost of living central to his reelection bid. As Joe Schultz reports, some Wisconsin consumers say that relief hasn't materialized. This week, WPR is taking a look at how the administration's policies have reshaped Wisconsin 1 year in.
During a campaign rally in Green Bay the month before the presidential election, Donald Trump promised the crowd that if voters sent him back to the White House, he would reduce prices and end inflation.
I will make America affordable again. We're going to make it affordable. We've got to bring those costs down. They call it groceries. Bacon, lettuce, tomato, everything is so much higher than it ever was, and we're going to bring that down.
1 year after Trump's return to office, shoppers stopped to talk to WPR outside a Pick and Save grocery store in Oshkosh. They said keeping up with the cost of food is still a struggle. Here's Oshkosh residents Randy Dillon, Abigail Godkin, and Caitlin Feast.
The things I used to see on sale, they ain't there no more. I don't know who to blame, but anyway, it's not getting easier for people like me.
I definitely don't treat myself to things as much, just to make sure we have groceries instead.
It's ungodly insane for how much you're paying to buy in bulk. So you're having to actually buy less, which almost seems like you're paying more.
Food prices have gone up since Trump returned to office. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, they were 3.1% higher in December 2025 than they were in the final month of 2024. That's well below the more than 10% spike in grocery prices shoppers saw in 2022. But it's still higher than the inflation rate consumers were used to in the decade before the pandemic. Experts and business leaders say sweeping tariffs imposed by the Trump administration are one reason costs have stayed high. Trump has made higher tariffs a centerpiece of his economic policies. He alluded to his plans during a campaign stop in Milwaukee in 2024.
The most beautiful word in the entire dictionary, you know what it is? It's tariff. The tariff. You're going to become so rich with the word tariff.
The administration has said their plan is meant to help bolster domestic manufacturing and increase federal revenue. But economists warn that tariffs are a form of tax on imports that's typically passed on to consumers. They say Trump's actions could help fuel inflation. In November, the average tariff rate in the U.S. was the highest it's been since 1935. That's according to the Budget Lab at Yale, a policy research center. John Rico is with the Budget Lab. He says researchers anticipate that when Trump's plan is fully phased in, it will translate to an average household loss of purchasing power of between $1,700 and $1,300. In November, Trump signed an executive order removing tariffs from a range of foods, like coffee, bananas, and beef.
The fact that the administration has explicitly exempted certain products from the tariff regime in order to bring prices down is perhaps evidence that policymakers believe that tariffs do indeed raise prices.
Tariffs have also affected Wisconsin manufacturers. A recent industry survey found 72% say they've been hit by the administration's import taxes. More than half cited cost increases as the biggest impact. About a third pointed to uncertainty and difficulty planning. Brookfield-based Gilman Precision is a manufacturer that has benefited. CEO Paul Grekowitz says the company gets most of its materials domestically and has received new business from companies looking to return their supply chains to the U.S.
Tariffs may have leveled the playing field a little bit more and made us a lot more competitive.
Another major sector in Wisconsin that's been affected by trade tensions is agriculture. Crop farmers last year faced higher production costs, lower crop prices, and trade disruptions. That includes China boycotting purchases of U.S. soybeans. Alan Johnson is a grain and beef farmer from Grant County. He supports the president's tariffs.
I'm not saying it's a great idea, but he's trying to do the right thing. Now, whether or not this is going to work, that remains to be seen.
Johnson says he took a loss on his crops last year, but high beef prices helped him stay afloat. Joe Schultz, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Tomorrow, we'll have a story on the impact of cuts to education spending in Wisconsin. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. Wisconsin's population is getting older. The number of people over 65 is estimated to increase from almost 780,000 in 2010 to over 1.5 million in 2040. That's according to projections from the state's Department of Administration, and the younger population is not keeping pace. The shift to an older population is even bigger in northern and rural parts of Wisconsin, and that could bring challenges with fewer people in the prime workforce age and a growing need for more senior healthcare and housing. We're looking into a variety of impacts on aging population and how it could impact Wisconsin. Demographer David Egan Robertson has been following these trends for years in his work with UW-Madison's Applied Population Laboratory. He spoke with Rob Ferret.
Now, I'm looking at these numbers from the State Department of Administration showing this rise in the proportion of people over 65, people over 85. I'm thinking this looks like a pretty big story that maybe we're not talking about enough. How big is this shift to an older population in Wisconsin?
Yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon. That's certainly the fastest age range of growth has been and probably for the next decade will be in the age 65 plus group. I went back to 2010 and looked forward to the latest age estimates that the Census Bureau provided, which run through 2024. So as you may know, with estimates, we're always running a year or two behind. But across that time in Wisconsin, the state gained about 400,000 more seniors, and that was about a 50% increase over the number at 2010. And that, I mean, it's a parallel situation nationally. The growth in the elderly population has been about 52% over the last 14, 15 years.
Are we seeing what we might call the prime workforce demographic keeping up with that pace?
No, yeah. So as demographers, we usually define the traditional working age population as ages 18 to 64. And that has stayed pretty level for quite some time, using, you know, like decennial censuses, which really are the best sort of post at which to compare. From like 2010 to 2020, that age group from 18 to 64 basically stayed level in Wisconsin. The elderly population grew, and then the younger population under age 18 declined during that time.
I want to get into some of the demographic nuts and bolts here as to why these things are happening. And I guess with demography, we often start thinking with things like birth and death rates and fertility. What are the big stories, I guess, in the last 7 decades that are putting us in this trend now?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, if you want to go back that far.
Well, that's the age group we're talking about, right?
Right, yeah. Exactly. So, right. At the older ages, much of the increase is being driven by the large, what we call the baby boom population. These were people born from about 1946 through 1964. Right now, in terms of those who have survived to their 60s now, and then also immigration that's happened across time, you know, the average size of those single year age cohorts, like around age 65 right now, is over 4 million people. So you've got this big wave that really started in 1946 to 64. They're now largely reaching past age 65. And in fact, the sort of the front edge of the baby boom, those born in 1946, will actually hit 80 this year.
And you mentioned migration. Now, sometimes if we have lots of people maybe in that older age group, we might think, well, that's okay. Younger people might move in and fill out the workforce that that the older people might be departing. What do we see when it comes to people moving in and out of Wisconsin?
Yeah, and in terms of international migration, the Census Bureau collects data asking people who are born in foreign countries, you know, when they moved from abroad. And so in the past 15 years or so, about 135,000 people have moved into Wisconsin from other countries. So it's not a huge percentage. That's a little more than 2% of our state's population. But international migrants, as you might expect, are generally younger than the existing what we call native-born population. In fact, their median age is about 31 and a half, whereas statewide, the median age is 40 and a half. So like among immigrants over the last 14, 15 years, more than half of them are in the age range of 25 to 44. So they are actually helping in a way keep down our median age and helping to build up and fill that sort of working age population.
Now, I know you, I believe I've talked to you in the past, David, and you've not really made value judgments on what is a good or bad demographic trend, but that said, with a higher proportion of the population being the older age group, that's going to create some changes, maybe some challenges. Are we in uncharted territory here? Do we have a lot of reference points for, you know, having places where that 65 plus population might be 30%, 35% of a state's population?
Well, yeah, I mean, you can look at some of the counties within Wisconsin. Certainly in the experience of counties, and these are largely the ones up north, which tend to have a lot of recreational housing, people are retiring up there. Those counties already have like a third of their population over age 65. So those are places where there's a big shift happening. They also have a much smaller proportion in a lot of northern counties in terms of kids under age 18. So in a lot of cases, the number of seniors is more than twice the number of children in a lot of counties now. Whereas statewide, they're fairly even. The state's over 65 population is about 20%, under age 18 is about 21%. So they're very close in terms of percentages, but they're skewed quite widely in terms of a lot of the northern counties in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I'm looking at the map from the State Department of Administration report, and it is amazing how in some of these projections, even the current numbers, you've got Dane County about 18% projected by 2030 in that 65 over age group. Okay. And then some of those, that northern belt you mentioned, you could have as high as 36, 37, even as high as 43% of the population, nearing half in that 65 and over. This is not exactly the same story in every county in the state, is it?
No, not at all. Yeah. And for, you know, decades now, it's been very traditional for the up north counties to have a lot more older people. And again, it's driven a lot by retirees, people, you know, we have lots of anecdotal stories of, you know, people owned a cabin or a cottage up north during their working years, and then they retired, and then they moved up to the northern counties and, you know, winterized their cabins and cottages and are living year-round up there. Yeah, it's a situation where, you know, there are just very, very high numbers in percentages, which might help to portend what's going to happen in the future for the counties that are more in the southern part of the state.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us again.
Okay, you're quite welcome, Rob.
That's David Egan Robertson, retired demographer with UW-Madison Applied Population Laboratory. So the state is getting older on average, and there are more people in higher age ranges. Now we turn to efforts in the state to help communities become more aging-friendly. Sarah Ritchie is the Lifespan Program Manager at UW-Madison's Division of Extension. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Before we dig into maybe particular communities and what they've done, big picture, what does it mean for a community to be aging friendly?
Well, as we think about aging friendly communities, they're communities that are inclusive, sustainable, healthy. They're ensuring that people have an opportunity to lead fulfilling and connected lives and have access to the things that they need to age in place. They provide an opportunity to celebrate the strengths and contributions of older adults and have an infrastructure that supports them and the services to meet their needs as well, actually, for all of us as we grow older, because we are all aging. So an aging-friendly community is really an everyone-friendly community.
As we just heard with David, a lot of counties are seeing the proportion of their population, age 65 and older, increasing over time. How important is it for communities to meet the needs of seniors as we see this underlying demographic shift in the state?
Yeah, I think for, especially when we think about those rural communities that are seeing a decline in population, a lot of times if a community can't support its older residents, those older residents have to also leave.
Now, you've been working with some communities around the state as they try to become more aging friendly, and I imagine a project in one place might be very different than in another. What are some of the particular things, big and small, that you've seen communities work on to try to become more aging friendly?
Yeah, so in Extension, we have educators that are located in communities all across the state. So what's unique about that is they have that connection to the university, the resources within the university, and a statewide network of professionals that are campus-based and community-based, working to build capacity within their community partners by providing them with leadership, tools, education, support to help meet the needs of those older people in the community. So, for example, in Kewaunee County, they have the Mastery Makers, which is a designation of local community leaders that are over the age of 60, and they are dedicated in their work to reducing negative views of aging, reducing ageism, and making the county more aging friendly. So the Extension has provided leadership and training, working alongside their coalition to create basically this network of leaders in the community that are dedicated just to creating aging-friendly, inclusive spaces. In another community, in Oconto County, we have an educator there who has been working with their school district leaders to implement universal design strategies that not only support older people, but also support people with mobility issues or those living with disabilities, and increasing access to attend community events. Like, we know in our rural communities how important youth sports are and how big those football games and basketball games can be for engagement of older people in getting out and seeing their youth play. So some of the schools are installing handrails on the bleachers so that it makes it easier for people to get up and safer. They are offering live streaming within the school to avoid overcrowded areas for people that may have a little trouble navigating. Also offering golf cart rides to the bleachers at outdoor events. So if the walk from the parking lot is quite a ways to where the bleachers are, people have a way of getting there a little bit easier. Reserving bottom rows for accessibility, so in the bleachers, people won't have to navigate stepping over people or walking up those stairs. and then installing handrails along outdoor sidewalks. Some communities have actually designated specific parking during community events for older people or people with mobility issues, in addition to some of those maybe handicapped parking spaces that are already available, but they've gone above and beyond that and created signage to dedicate parking spaces that are closer to event. Sometimes I think that makes it a little easier for people to come out knowing that they won't have to walk a long distance to get to that event. A lot of these programs also build in education on awareness of aging, what normal aging looks like, how we talk and think about aging in an effort to reduce ageism. I think ageism is really at the foundation of aging-friendly communities work. Once we recognize that we should embrace aging, our older people in our community carry wisdom and strength and a rich history, and we should be celebrating that and not looking at it as a burden or a challenge.
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
And that is Sarah Ritchie, Lifespan Program Manager at UW-Madison's Division of Extension. We also heard from David Egan Robertson, retired demographer with UW-Madison's Applied Population Lab. They talked with Rob Ferret about Wisconsin's aging population. We'll have more conversations about aging in the state in the weeks to come, and we want to hear from you. If you are in that 65-plus age range, or your parents are, what are the things you think we should be talking about when it comes to seniors in Wisconsin and in your community? What are the best and worst things for life over 65? Let us know. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Coming up, a daughter discovers her late father's handwritten reading list with thousands of titles and creates the What Dan Read Project.
Going back all the way to 1964 and how organized it was, what a document.
The legacy of one man's love of reading and public libraries. That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. When Dan Pelzer passed away last year at age 92, he left behind a handwritten list of 3,599 books he had read as an adult. He started keeping track of the books he was reading in 1962 while serving as a Peace Corps volunteer in Nepal. For the rest of his adult life, he made it his personal goal to read at least 100 pages every day. Dan's interests spanned a wide range of genres, and his list is still sparking conversations about one man's dedication to reading. Now, his daughter, Marcy Pelzer of Milwaukee, is the keeper of this list, which runs more than 100 pages. She is sharing her dad's story through a website and social media project called What Dan Read. Marcy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. My dad was a big public radio listener, so he'd be so pleased.
Oh, so based on this list, your dad logged nearly 3,600 books in his adult life, and it sounds like he was a voracious reader. What memories do you have of your dad reading?
Well, you know, I thought all dads read voraciously until I was a lot older. But some of the most special memories were my dad taking me to all libraries in Columbus. We went to three different ones. We spent Saturday mornings at the downtown library in Columbus, Ohio, sitting in a treehouse in the children's room reading children's books. So that's my favorite memory with my dad.
Did he have you pick out the books, or was he leading you what to read?
No, we picked out our own books. He wanted us to read what we loved. And, you know, what was important to my dad was a good story. And he was always happy when he found a book that was a real page turner. So in the end, that's what he was looking for.
It's so sweet that you bring that up, because I think that's the last line of the obituary. You could also honor Dan by reading a real page turner. Do you think of your dad when you're devouring a book and unable to put it down?
Oh, absolutely. I always think of the conversations we used to have about books, the things we liked, the things we read together, and also, you know, just the experiences of reading throughout his life as I go on without him, knowing that he was reading All the President's Men when my brother was born, and he read Love Story the week before he went on his first date with my mom. When he took me to kindergarten, he was reading Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance on my first day of kindergarten. So it's so special to discover those things after he's gone.
You didn't find out that your dad was keeping this reading list until you were an adult. What was it like to stumble onto this extra detail about your father's life?
Oh, it was incredible because he was so nonchalant about it. We think he was keeping it at work all those years. And so the first time I ever saw it, he was living in the retirement home and I was in my 30s. And I couldn't believe it. Going back all the way to 1964 and how organized it was and what a document.
I loved how it went from his handwriting to a typewriter, back to handwriting to typewriter. You know, I just, the documentation seemed like whatever was, you know, he had there at the moment, or, you know, what do you know about that and how he put these books down?
Well, it's just interesting to think about what kind of, what he had access to at the time. When he was in Peace Corps, he certainly couldn't type. And I suspect when he was in the seminary in the 60s, he couldn't type. And then, you know, he was a big typewriter guy, not a computer guy ever. And so you can see his typing mistakes and you can see, you know, running out of ink and all of the, you know, also writing on work letterhead and purchase orders. And there's one page that is a brochure from the hospital when one of them was having surgery in their senior years. So it really is the story of his life.
I also noticed there's, I think it's an asterisk next to the gospel according to Mark. And it made me think about your dad as a spiritual person. I mean, how did that show up in his selections?
He was a deeply spiritual person. He was in the seminary to become a Jesuit, very Catholic all his life. So you can see kind of every kind of Catholic book. But also he was very interested in world religions and faith traditions that were different from his own. And I always like to tell people that, you know, you never think this deeply religious man is also reading the sex columnist Dan Savage, but he read that too.
As you go through your dad's list, I mean, what are some of the books that have most surprised you or that you wish you could have been able to discuss with him?
Sometimes he read things that were more self-helpy than I would have thought. I'm not a fan of M. Scott Peck, and he read a lot of those books. So sometimes I read those books and I think, did you get a lot of value out of those, Dad? Or were you reading those just because if you started a series, you finished it? The funniest one that we'd like to talk about is that he read all the L. Ron Hubbard books. And we knew he didn't like them, but once he started a series, you finished it.
Can you talk about that ability to finish a book you start and what that discipline was like in your father?
Yeah, I mean, he famously told the Columbus Dispatch in 2006 that he found Ulysses to be pure torture. He told us the L. Ron Hubbard books were a slog, and it was just part of the discipline. He went at it 100 books a day, and he always had something he was reading, ordering, about to pick up, about to pursue. And, you know, on the other hand, he really loved a real page-turner. If you look at his records, you'll see he read all but one of the Alphabet Mysteries by Sue Grafton. I believe she didn't finish the last one in her lifetime. More than 20 John Grishams. More than 20 Robert Ludlums. So all over the map for him.
How many books was he reading at once? I mean, I wonder what his bedside table was like.
Oh, no, never more than one. He was methodical. He read one. He finished it. He took it back. He was never late when he took books back to the library. He lost his mind when I had late fees, which I always did. And then
you're no daughter of mine.
No daughter of mine. Exactly. And then when we talked to the librarians after he died, they said that they would see him coming in and they would try to recommend books, and he always knew what he wanted. So he came in the library with a list based on what people had recommended to him, what he had read from. And then, you know, throughout the life, his life, he followed lists, like reading all the great books of the Western world, reading all the modern library top 100s, and he loved reading the books that Obama recommended.
There's also the book 400 Things Cops Should Know, from a classmate at Marquette. Why did he read this?
I don't know. I was staring at the list for several months after, probably about 4 months after my dad died, I recognized the name of my classmate, Adam Planinga, and he had gone to Marquette with me. I graduated from Marquette in 95, and then Adam lived in Milwaukee and was a beat cop for several years, and I would have loved to talk to my dad about knowing Adam, what brought him to that book, what interested him about policing. But I never knew that until after he was gone. And that was just kind of a fun connection and, you know, question that comes up when reading the list.
We're talking with Marcy Pelzer of Milwaukee. She's the daughter of Dan Pelzer, who passed away in the summer and made headlines around the world for leaving behind a handwritten list of 3,599 books he had read during his adult life. Marcy, as keeper of this list now, you have it at your home in Milwaukee. How has it become part of your story now?
It's a pleasure because every time I talk to people, they want to tell me about their own book lists, their parents' reading habits, how much they value the library, what I should be reading next. And so it's opened up this whole conversation about books and reading. And what would be most special to my dad is really getting people back to the library. He loved the library so much, and the thought that his book list was getting people to take out their library cards and go browse the books and pick out something really great, that would make him so happy.
Most of the books your dad read were borrowed from the public library. What kind of reaction are you seeing from libraries now?
Oh, they're so touched. And the Columbus Library was amazing. They actually digitized the list, so you can go on their website and it's searchable, and you can search by author, by year, by title, all of that, by topic. And they also did these special displays that drove people back into the library to pick up one of his books. And libraries across the country have done those little displays. Or one of the most special things to me has been the young people who have heard about my dad on TikTok, and they make TikToks about what Dan was reading the day they were born. And they say that he walked so good reads could run, and they call him the Michael Jordan of reading. And I just love those clever TikTokers because, you know, there's no one more clever than a reader.
What would Dan think of TikTok?
Oh, he wouldn't know what to make of it. He's not he was never a technology person. He got tweeting and texting mixed up, and he would talk about us being good at finding Facebooks, which I think meant internet research. Yeah. It just wasn't his thing.
Did he talk about the things that he learned from these books? Did his insights come up in casual conversation?
Well, certainly about history and world events. And, you know, he had been a history teacher, and especially earlier in his career. So he's the person you'd go to about anything about history and world politics, certainly. But, you know, the interesting thing is he didn't really push the reading list on people. It was very private. Nobody knew about it. Nobody would have known about it if we hadn't found it in 2006 and, you know, given it to the media. It was just, I think he was trying to challenge himself, trying to remember, trying to keep track. And I wish he could have seen the data later on and realized what authors he accidentally read more than once. And, you know, even I think it would surprise him to know who his top five authors were, things like that.
Who were his top five authors?
Paul Strathern, who wrote a series about philosophers in 90 Minutes. Sue Grafton, William Kienzel, who was a Catholic priest who wrote mysteries. He wrote the Rosary Mysteries. John Grisham and Robert Ludlum. He read more than 20 of all of their books.
Wow. You know, you've started this project, What Dan Read, website, social media accounts. What are your hopes for this project? Do you think it could spark a love of reading or more support for public libraries?
Absolutely. A conversation about books, a place for book lovers to find one another. And I'm also hoping that there's a book in it someday. So stay tuned about that. Nothing immediate.
What do you think about, you know, the handwritten list in a moment when people are hunched over their phones, everything is so digitized? Does this kind of embrace the analog in a way? You know, I when I looked at it, that's the thing that popped out to me was his handwriting and the typewriter. Does that, do you think, have an impact on how we see this list?
Yes, and especially beyond it just being analog, the joy you can find in the most simple of pleasures, you know, what you can find at the library, an afternoon spent over the pages reading, a conversation at a book club. I think in a world that sometimes seems overly complicated and overly scary right now, thinking about getting back to the simple pleasures, I think that's what's speaking to people.
Did your dad set aside time to read, or was it a certain time of day? How did he go about, you know, finishing all of these books?
Well, we know that, you know, he got a lot of reading done on his bus commute, which was probably 2 hours a day during all the years he was working. We fully believe that he was reading at his day job. We think he was reading at work. But I mean, the other fun story is money was tight when we were little, and he sometimes worked two jobs. He was a security guard at the Marriott in our side of town in Columbus. And so he'd work 12 to 8. And we know he read all night on that job. It was a great job for him because, you know, not a lot of action after the little cocktail lounge closed. So, yeah, he always found time to read. I would say he didn't read in bed, always in an easy chair. And then in his retirement days, you know, he just set a page goal and would tell you, you know, I got to get back to it. I got to finish my 100 pages today.
Marcy, thank you so much for sharing about Dan. It's been such a pleasure learning about his life with books.
Thank you. It was a pleasure for me, too.
That is Marcy Pelzer, the Milwaukee woman behind the project called What Dan Read. It's a tribute to her late father, Dan Pelzer, who had a love of reading and patronizing public libraries. Dan passed away last year at age 92, leaving behind a list of nearly 3,600 books he read during his adult life. His last entry in his reading list is dated December 30th, 2023, with David Copperfield by Charles Dickens. A dozen Wisconsin chefs, restaurants, and bars have been named semifinalists in the prestigious 2026 James Beard Awards. We think of these awards as the Oscars of the food world. The James Beard Foundation, which oversees the awards, will narrow down the list to the finalists in coming weeks. But in the meantime, let's do a few shout-outs from the group. Congrats to Cultured of Sister Bay in the Outstanding Bakery category. In Milwaukee, the Mothership, semifinalist for Outstanding Bar. And also in Milwaukee, 1033 Omakase for Best New Restaurant. And to all the other names on the list, you are making Wisconsin proud in the culinary and drink scene. Wisconsin Today producers include Mackenzie Crummy and Rochelle Wilson. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.